Bruderhof Radio. I'm your host, Andrew Zimmerman. This week on Bruderhof Radio, the newest commentaries from Mumia Abu-Jamal, the Pennsylvania death row inmate and journalist whose very name sparks controversy around the world. During his 17 years on death row, Mumia Abu-Jamal has become a cause celeb, garnering support from people such as Archbishop Desmond Tutu, Alice Walker, and E.L. Doctorow, as well as the European Parliament, the Congressional Black Caucus, and Amnesty International. While some, like the Philadelphia-based MOVE group, call for his immediate release, others demand a new trial, saying his original trial in 1982 was biased and unfair. The movement to free Mumia is now so broad that his name consistently appears at the meetings and demonstrations of numerous other activist groups, such as those fighting police brutality and advocating prison reform. Supporters of Abu-Jamal say he was wrongfully convicted of murdering Philadelphia police officer Daniel Faulkner in 1981. At that time, Abu-Jamal was a rising journalist. He served as president of the Philadelphia chapter of the Association of Black Journalists and was acclaimed for his work at National Public Radio and at local Philadelphia stations. His supporters say he was targeted because of his outspoken and critical coverage of police corruption and violence in Philadelphia in the late 1970s. But whether or not Abu-Jamal actually killed Officer Faulkner in 1981 will, in all likelihood, remain a mystery. In the meantime, his eloquent and timely critiques of government and society continue to be heard by the public. The San Francisco-based Prison Radio Project has released two albums of his commentaries, recorded from 1993 to 1996 at various penitentiaries in Pennsylvania. However, soon after these recordings were made, prison officials denied him further media access, and live on-site recordings and interviews are now impossible. But in recent months, Bruderhof Radio has recorded a number of Abu-Jamal's commentaries over the telephone, including a commencement speech he wrote and performed for the students and faculty of Evergreen State College in Washington. This speech created a national controversy when it was played at the ceremony in May. Abu-Jamal's most biting commentary came after Vanity Fair magazine published an article in which a certain Philip Block claimed to have heard Abu-Jamal's confession of murder in a 1992 visit. Mr. Block is a former member of the Pennsylvania Prison Society, an inmate advocacy organization. The article received substantial press coverage as opponents of Abu-Jamal lauded this so-called conclusive evidence of his guilt. But largely ignored was the fact that the article's author, Buzz Bissinger, was once a publicist for Ed Rendell, the Philadelphia district attorney at the time of Abu-Jamal's original trial. In this piece from late July, Abu-Jamal discusses his meeting with Block in 1992 and wonders why he is only now publicizing the so-called confession.
News item. A 47-year-old substitute teacher announces he heard former Black Panther Mumia Abu-Jamal admit murdering a Philadelphia police officer. Vanity Fair magazine features an interview with Philip Block, who tells a reporter that Jamal made the admission to him during a visit in winter of 1992 at Huntington Prison. The FOP applauds Block's courage, and the Philadelphia DA's office announces this is proof of Jamal's guilt. End of news item. For the better part of a week in summer 1999, newspapers ran banner headlines. Talk shows did a brisk business in the above.
This call is coming from a correctional facility.
Gossip-oriented Disney-owned 2020 show called it a significant development in the Jamal case and shamelessly hyped the show's new witness from a man who claimed he was a close personal friend. In a startling departure from journalistic standards, not a single newspaper or so-called news show bothered to check his tail with me, nor to check him out with the Pennsylvania Prison Society, the agency that he was briefly affiliated with during his visits to state prisons in Pennsylvania. Instead, using the old "they did it, so we can do it too" justification, papers and other media leaped at the chance to sell papers with this hot new story. You could almost hear them drooling at this scoop. Stop the presses. Rarely has one lie drawn so much ink, so much videotape, or wasted ever seen cops embrace snitches so warmly? In truth, cops hate snitches, as should be clear from cop cases where cops tell on other cops. Do you think the cops who testified as to the brutal assault on Abner Louima in New York City were hailed for their courage, or were they damned and ostracized? What do you think? Block claims I was a close personal friend of his, yet he admits his letters went unanswered for years. If his tale is true, isn't he a snitch and a traitor? Yet there is no truth to Block's revelations, as will be seen by his own words. Again, just for the sake of argument, let us suppose all of what he said is true. Why would he write the following words to me over 6 months after my quote-unquote confession to him? Quote, I watched the movie Incident at Oglala last month after Leonard Peltier's co-defendants were acquitted by the jury in a separate trial. The FBI, interviewed on camera, were saying that the jurors and their families had been intimidated by Indians. Then they interviewed the foreman of the jury, and he said that nobody on the jury had ever seen any Indians. There was no truth to the FBI allegations. Then the juror said to the camera, I thought that the FBI agents were going to kill all of us, the jury, after the verdict was read. So it is possible to get justice from a jury. Not always, but sometimes. So, when you get a new trial, I think that there's a good chance of acquittal. The letter is dated July 17th, 1993, and it's signed by Phil Block. Question. Why write to a guy and write about a new trial or acquittal if that guy confessed his guilt to you? The answer is simple. There was no confession. Period. Mr. Block knew that 6 months after the time of his alleged confession, which means he is lying now. Did Block, like the cops of the 6th District, conveniently forget this confession also? I don't know, and frankly, I don't care why he has come forward now. Perhaps he's frustrated that he's still a substitute teacher and wants a push from his friends in high places. Perhaps he seeks the warm glow of limelight. Who knows? Who cares? By his own words, it proves he may not be a snitch, nor much of a traitor, but he is a liar. By this episode, he's proven how truly low trash journalism can go. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
As a victim of America's often unfair court system, Abu-Jamal was justifiably concerned when Lita, a Pennsylvania Capital Defense Organization providing services to death row inmates, closed this summer due to lack of funding. At his 1982 trial, Abu-Jamal was allocated only $2,500 for his defense, including the hiring of lawyers and forensics experts. And he is only one of thousands of poor defendants who suffer similar economic and racial bias within the justice system. Such biases have resulted in poor and minority defendants receiving death sentences in much higher proportions than white or richer defendants. Over the years, organizations like LIDA have helped numerous inmates gain stays of execution, and in some cases have obtained commutations from capital punishment to life sentence. After hearing of LIDA's demise, Abu-Jamal penned this report.
In Pennsylvania, defense for people on death row is dead. After years of cuts of state and federal funding, and unsuccessful attempts to raise the funds privately from foundations and the like, the law offices handling the appeals and post-conviction proceedings of a vast majority of the 200-plus men and women on the row recently shut its doors. For most of these men and women who come from backgrounds of stark poverty, they awake today to learn, through media reports or from jailhouse rumor, that they are now unrepresented at a time when the state is signing a flood of death warrants. A few days before the nation celebrates the rights and liberties of the 4th of July, the primal right to life, as protected by the right to meaningful defense counsel, said to be guaranteed by the U.S. Constitution, vanishes like mist in the fierce summer sun. The Sixth Amendment to the Constitution says in part, quote, in all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to speedy and public trial by an impartial jury and to have the assistance of counsel for his defense, unquote. To hundreds of those in Pennsylvania, determination by the state, there is now no counsel at all. In a letter to his colleagues recently, Robert Dunham, the lawyer who led the law office, said the state's cuts made the office's closing all but inevitable. He wrote, quote, "Unfortunately, the Commonwealth has failed to address any of the systemic failures to provide indigent capital representation that made our services so necessary," unquote. Dunham added, quote, "While we were able to survive much, we simply could not weather the Commonwealth's intractable resistance to funding capital defense services, which was greater even than its usual reluctance to provide legal services to the indigent," unquote. In their 5 years of operation, Dunham's group, called LIDA, won 163 stays of execution and overturned 12 death sentences, half of which are now life terms. The raging Republican war against the poor meant no funding for LIDA and the slow attrition of their effectiveness. If a man or woman standing on the brink of death has no real right to a lawyer because he or she can't afford one, then the constitutional right to assistance of counsel is but a cruel joke. They stand at the tender mercies of the state, undefended, unrepresented, and before a government that wants to kill them as quickly and as quietly as possible. That is our reality on the eve of the next century, where so-called constitutional rights and rap about liberty and justice for all is just another lie. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Such commentaries are no doubt unpopular with Pennsylvania state and prison officials, but other organizations applaud Abu-Jamal's efforts. In July, Penn Oakland awarded Abu-Jamal their third annual Literacy Censorship Award. This award is given to, quote, "outstanding writers of literature of conscience who have been victims of the peculiar American institutions of censorship, and who have endured efforts to discredit them, and those who have sustained the failure of mainstream institutions to publish, distribute, or review their works." Penn Oakland is a chapter of International Penn, an association of novelists, poets, playwrights, and other writers, founded in 1921 to champion freedom of expression and fight censorship. Upon receiving this award, Abu-Jamal, who was once known as the voice of the voiceless, recorded this commentary on the journalism of the lower classes.
Chair, judges, and membership of Penn Oakland for this remarkable award. I accept it in the spirit in which Live from Death Row was written, on behalf of the damned and the oppressed, those, to borrow Professor Derek Bell's apt phrase, who are but, quote, voices from the bottom of the well, unquote. Let us not accept the soft and easy logic that these people are voiceless. No, rather, it is perhaps truer that their voices are ignored by most of the white supremacist media. They're not voiceless. In the hells of Huntington Prison's B block, there wasn't silence, but the cacophony of chaos, the rage of people entombed in a torture chamber, and the bellows of madness. Their voices ring to the very vaults of heaven for distant tastes of justice. Those are the voices that fill the pages of Live from Death Row. And it is in their name that I'm honored to accept this award. For Black Manny, who was almost killed by a prison doctor. For Solo, acquitted in a courtroom, yet condemned by a kangaroo court of venal prison officials. Chuck Africa, the MOVE political prisoner, attacked, chained, and exported to out-of-state dungeons in the aftermath of the Camp Hill riots of 1989. The valiant sisters and brothers of the Black Panther Party of the past, and the MOVE organization of the present. Their voices filled my ear during my sojourn through hell and charged my pen with the ancient African spirit of resistance, that stuff seeded in us by our ancestors. Several months after Live's publication, the Pennsylvania prison officials charged me with violating rules against operating a business or profession. The profession? Journalism. When I tried to explain that this was a violation of the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution and similar provisions in the Pennsylvania Constitution, well, the hearing examiner rejected the argument, saying it had nothing to do with rights. She spelled it R-I-T-E-S. The prison official convicted and sentenced me to 90 days in the hole, despite the fact that as I was under a death warrant, I had less than 90 days to live. It took one of their courts to explain their constitutions to them several years later to explain coming as it does from a group such as yours, a group of distinguished and accomplished writers and journalists who've known the crucial difference between a right, R-I-T-E, and a right, R-I-G-H-T. To paraphrase that old and wonderful slogan that began over 30 years ago in your town of Oakland, I promise to...
This call is coming from a correctional facility.
Ah, right on. On the move. Long live John Africa's revolution. Freedom is our right and destiny. Still, live from death row, this is Mumia Abu Jamal.
You're listening to Mumia Abu Jamal, live from death row on Bruderhof Radio. For detailed information on Abu Jamal's case, check out www.mumia.org. As a prison journalist, Abu Jamal routinely faces censorship. Most often it is covert. Mail is opened and phone calls are monitored. Other times the censorship is more blatant, as on August 12th when Abu Jamal's live interview on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Was cut short by prison officials who apparently ripped the telephone from the wall and said, quote, "This call is terminated, the order comes straight from the top." Because of such experiences, Abu Jamal vocalized his support of KPFA radio staff members when, earlier this summer, they were locked out of their Berkeley, California radio station. In brief, KPFA programmers disagreed with parent organization Pacifica Radio on how much the internal affairs of Pacifica should be discussed on the air. In this piece from June 24th, Abu Jamal warns against the corporatization of media.
The struggles of the staffers at Pacifica's flagship in San Francisco is a fundamental one. It's about the freedom of the mind. It is not, as administrators suggest, a battle for progress, nor professionalism. These terms are but media speak for the NPRization of KPFA and a flight away from the radical segments of the community into the faux relevance of yuppiedom. Without the open microphone that has become the laudable hallmark of the Pacifica Network, the radical sparks that fire whole communities will be marginalized to the narrow bands of micro-radio, if not vanished altogether, if capital and its minions in government have their way. Former Pacifica President Peter Frank hit the nail on the head when he wrote, quote, "I think the thing that has to be remembered is that Pacifica is a profoundly subversive, very dangerous organization, and there is a strong impetus from Washington to mute it," unquote. One wonders, what is subversive? What's dangerous? In a state where the very gene pool is being swiftly commodified, nothing is more dangerous than the sound of critical resistance.
This call is coming from a correctional facility.
Looks to the people, not to corporations, for its very existence. For capital, such an entity threatens their total hegemony and domination. I've fought enough against the gags and muzzles of the state to recognize a similar gag job. It's for that reason that I joined with womanist wordsmith Alice Walker, feisty poet June Jordan, linguist and teacher Noam Chomsky, people's historian Howard Zinn, Fair, the Alameda Central Labor Council, and Berkeley's progressive city council in siding with the beleaguered staff of KPFA who are rumbling against Pacifica management and the recent crushing of dissent. Rehire Sawaya and Bensky. For free air, on the move, from death row, this is Mumia Abu Jamal.
After following the bombing campaign against Yugoslavia this spring, Abu Jamal called in this statement of support for a New York-based tribunal seeking to indict NATO and United States officials for crimes against humanity. This scathing critique of American imperialism was recorded on July 30th.
This is a letter in support of the Commission of Inquiry to investigate the U.S.-NATO war crimes against Yugoslavia. In an age when death, war, and loss have become little more than a virtual video game, the efforts of this commission have become invaluable. For what you see here, what you learn here, will differ greatly from what the corporate media projects to you. For them, war is but another commodity used to boost network ratings so that advertising rates can be increased, so that profits can soar. For many, war is big business. Lost on them is the loss of life, the ravaging of the environment, the destruction of whole societies. The American Empire, working through its instrument, NATO, achieves its imperial interests of economic and political domination. War is almost always a conflict that is based on economics. This entire conflict in the Balkans has its roots in the desire of globalist capitalist forces to quiet and stifle international discord in order to spread the new world order of commodification.
This call is coming from a correctional facility.
If the Balkans were situated in Africa, as in the case of Rwanda, it would have been virtually ignored. We all know this. I therefore wish this commission every success. On a move. Long live John Africa. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu Jamal.
In addition to commenting on current affairs, Abu Jamal sometimes reads from his published works. The following selection, entitled Man of the Cloth, originally appeared in the book Death Blossoms in 1997.
Pam Africa, minister and disciple of the teachings of John Africa, tells a true tale of a meeting between the latter and a man of the cloth behind the old headquarters of the MOVE organization in the Powell Village section of West Philadelphia. The scene, a man, middle-aged, bearded, booted, and blue-jeaned, is called to the back door by the leader of a small group from a nearby church. Though both are black, they present a fascinating tableau of difference. The one wears a t-shirt, sweat soaking his breast. The other is impeccably dressed in silk suit and tie. The only touch missing is coattails. The one's hair is rough, gray-fringed, uncombed, and hanging like ropes to his shoulders. The other's is pomaded, greased, and brushed smooth, the head of a preacher man. The air is thick and charged with contraband.
This call is coming from a correctional facility.
For the city is threatening to remove MOVE from their property and their neighborhood after a series of highly publicized confrontations with the police that has left several MOVE men and women beaten and bloody and one MOVE baby dead. So you're saying all I gotta do is pray and everything will be all right? Well, that's what I'm saying, brother. If I pray, the cops will stop beating up my people? Yes, that's what I'm saying, brother. If I pray, the cops will stop killing us? Yes, pray. In Jesus' name, brother. Because the Bible says, ask, and it shall be given unto you. That's it, brother. And if I pray, our people will truly be free? Mm-hmm. Yes, sir, brother. Well, come on, Reverend. Let's pray then. John Africa drops to his knees, oblivious of the soft mud already staining his jeans. Whoa, what you doing, brother? You said we need to pray, right? Come on, Rep, pray with me, okay? I meant pray in the church. Why, Reverend? Ain't God out here in the open air? Ain't God all around us? Come on. Let's kneel down here on God's earth and pray. At this point, the Reverend backs up. And John Africa says, what's the matter? I thought you said we should pray. Well, come on down here and pray with me. The Reverend continues to stand there, staring. John Africa asks again, what's the matter, man? That suit you got on more important than God? I thought you said you believed in God. This dirt is God. So why don't you kneel down here and pray with me? Well, excuse me, brother, but I gotta be getting back to my church. At this point, the people standing around the two men began to speak. See that? That man is down there on his knees in the dirt. He got to be for real. That Reverend ain't nothing but a phony. He's scared he gonna dirty his suit. He talking about how he believe in God. He don't believe in nothing but that suit. One woman comments to another, that preacher's a hypocrite, see? That's why I don't go to no church, because I don't believe in them preachers, because they ain't nothing but liars, they ain't for real. That man there kneeling in that dirt, yeah, that's for real. John Africa goes on, you don't want to pray with me then, Rev? I gotta go, man. I'm sorry. Why you leaving, Rev? The dashing preacher beats a hasty retreat from the muddy yard, more intent, it seems, on saving silk than soul. Several years later, and several miles westward, the city with torch moves home and headquarters with a helicopter-borne firebomb incinerating John Africa and 10 other long hair, some of them women and children, in a massacre plotted to take place on Mother's Day. The scene, smoldering remains of an entire neighborhood, only hours before the site of a blistering, billowing inferno. Philadelphia's men of the cloth have gathered once again, though only to examine the carnage, not to weep for the fallen, nor to pray for the dead. They have come bedecked in robes and collars, the purpose of their gathering to pray in support of the mayor of the city that has bombed its own citizens and obliterated, incinerated, and dismembered its own babies. The police commissioner, the fire chief, the mayor, and his officers are almost to a man Christian, Baptists or Catholics, most of them, religious people. Yet these men who have gathered to pray are not only churchgoers, they're ministers, pastors, priests. Aside from praying, though, it seems that they mean to do little. Why should they? They've just winked at a full-scale war waged over mere misdemeanors, at the deaths of 11 people blasted by a sky bomb, the destruction of dozens of homes, and the permanent scarring of a neighborhood. And so they pray and leave for home, their duties fulfilled. Men of the cloth? Yes. But men of the spirit? This is Mounia Abu-Jamal reading from Death Blossoms.
To purchase Abu-Jamal's written works, Death Blossoms, or Live from Death Row, call Plow Publishing at 1-800-521-8011. To purchase compact discs of Abu-Jamal's commentaries recorded live in Pennsylvania prisons, call the Prison Radio Project at 415-648-4505. Again, that's Plow Publishing at 800-521-8011 or the Prison Radio Project at 415-648-4505. This program was produced by Andrew Zimmerman with assistance from Ben Wright. Bruderhof Radio is a production of the Bruderhof Communities, a communal movement based on Christ's Sermon on the Mount, in particular the teachings concerning brotherly love, love of enemies, mutual service, nonviolence, and the refusal to bear arms. Money and possessions are pooled voluntarily, and in turn each member is provided for and cared for. For more information about Bruderhof Radio, give us a call at 914-658-8351.